This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is getting things ready for Black Agenda Report's 7th anniversary celebration. Coming up, a suit against the United Nations for causing the death of 8,000 Haitians. A conference in Philadelphia on restarting a movement for social justice. And a minister tells the Black misleadership class to stop attacking Cornel West and Tavis Smiley. But first, a conference last weekend on the crisis facing Detroit. Activists from around the world gathered for the first International People's Assembly against banks and against austerity. At the top of the list of demands, cancellation of Detroit's debts to the banks. Conference organizer Abayomi Azikiwe says it's Wall Street's fault that Detroit is facing bankruptcy.
Yeah, it's totally illegitimate. The debt, there's a series of developments that have taken place in Detroit over the last decade and a half. First of all, was the targeting of the city of Detroit because of its predominantly African-American population and also the Latino community as well for subprime predatory mortgage loans. And that drove many people into indebtedness and, of course, drove them into foreclosure and eviction. And therefore, the last census period between 2000 and 2010, 237,000 people left or, in essence, were forced out of the city of Detroit. This had a tremendous impact on the tax revenue. When that happens, the city is forced into borrowing more, issuing more bonds at a more disadvantageous rate for the city as a whole, which the taxpayers have to make good. So these episodes of debt just keep compounding. And then, of course, they tell us that in order to get more loans, you have to institute austerity. You have to lay off city employees. You have to cut back on city services. We have to reduce contributions to pension funds. And this is the order of the day, even prior to the appointment of an emergency manager. But all of this, mind you, was still not enough to satisfy the powers that be, the banks and the corporations. They wanted even greater concessions. So therefore, they declared a financial emergency back in March. They appointed an emergency manager. He has been here now approaching 7 months, and the conditions have gotten worse. There's less bus service. There's less attention being paid to the streets and to the roads. There is a situation where over half the city is in darkness during the nighttime hours because the public lighting system is in such a vast disarray. And they're now contemplating turning it over to DTE Energy Corporation, which is the monopoly for the supply of electricity and gas in the Detroit metropolitan area, to privatize public lighting. This is a $20-plus billion valued corporation. And most of all, of course, is the morale of the municipal employees, which have gone down tremendously, because many of them have been subjected to up to a 20% pay cut over the last year. So they're not happy. They're not being as productive as they should be. And these are some of the variables that are going on right now in the city of Detroit. And also, we have the onslaught of the mayoral race, where we have two candidates running. Both have no real history of being involved in any type of people struggle or labor struggle. One is a Wayne County sheriff who was former chief of police in Detroit, whose actions in many ways were responsible for a federal investigation of Detroit police, which resulted a decade ago in the imposition of two federal consent decrees by the Justice Department, which the city of Detroit is still under. And another, who is a Caucasian political functionary, who was the previous CEO of Detroit Medical Center, which now has been privatized, which has been sold to a private corporation based in the state of Tennessee. So there's really no choice in terms of the mayoral race, which is going to be taking place next month.
You say there is no choice. Some would say there is no point, since the mayor and the city council have no power.
Well, we want to go beyond the mayor and the city council. They're just functionaries right now of Chase Bank, the Bank of America, U.S. Bank, United Bank of Switzerland. They're the ones who hold the debt for the city of Detroit. And that's why we are focusing so much attention on the banks and calling for the cancellation of the debt because we feel it's illegitimate is based upon the systematic destruction of the city through predatory lending, through predatory lending both in housing as well as in municipal finance. We believe that people in other cities have to adopt a similar strategy, that these politicians, they don't work for the people. They work for the banks and the corporations, and that's who we have to target in order to make any fundamental change during this period in history.
With the kind of levels of anger and frustration that you describe in Detroit, one would think this would be fertile ground for mass mobilization, or is there despair instead?
There's a mixture of both. We're bringing out more people. More people are working together. But at the same time, a lot of people have been beaten down by this whole process. Their homes have been taken away from them. They are in a situation where their salaries have been cut 10 to 20%. They're facing enormous personal problems. Like, for example, right now, I'm in southwest Detroit, and we're doing a defense of a home of a Latino family that's being threatened with eviction by Fannie Mae. So this is just one home and just one neighborhood, but this is taking place all over the city of Detroit. So in effect, these people can't feel comfortable about leaving their homes because the bailiff could show up at any time to evict them. So, of course, this is a major impediment of getting people involved in a mass struggle. So that's why we have to pledge our solidarity with the people in the neighborhoods whose homes are under threat, the pensioners whose checks every month are under threat, and the city municipal employees and the school teachers whose jobs are under threat, whose salaries are under threat. And that's the way we're going to build the movement here in Detroit, and I think we have to do that all over the country.
Adeyemi Ezekiwe is editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Dr. Cornel West, the black activist and scholar, and Tavis Smiley, the veteran broadcaster, have been vilified by Obama supporters for daring to criticize the president's policies. Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative says it's time for the attacks on West and Smiley to stop. Reverend Evans says Tavis Smiley and Dr. West are speaking truth to power, and their detractors are hypocrites.
Reverend Al Sharpton, we love that brother. We love Tom Joyner, and we love Ben Jealous. However, they have cozy up to the White House and told the White House that you don't have to worry about black folks getting out of line. We will keep them in line for you. And then when Tavis and Cornel West raised legitimate issues concerning policies, concerning the way that black folks have been treated, then on their orders, on Al Sharpton's orders, on Ben Jealous' orders, and on Tom Joyner's orders, they have sent the black elite after Tavis and after Cornel West, after raising legitimate issues in areas of housing, legitimate issues in the area of education, you've seen what's going on at Howard University, in economic development, and even of politics. One of the most frightening situations is that black women have supported this president at 98%. I cannot tell you of an issue that black women agree on at 98%. But when you look at black female appointments into key political positions, it is hard to find them. You take Marie Johns, for instance, who was the deputy under director of the Small Business Administration. When that position came open, she was passed over. She was not elevated to the administrator of the Small Business Administration. And this has happened time after time after time. When the administration had the opportunity to appoint the first black woman to the Supreme Court, it failed. It appointed two women, one from Harvard and one Latino woman, and they are not serving our interests. They're serving women's interests. And it goes to show you that the votes that they have, both of them has taken, even though they're so-called liberals, we can no more trust the liberals than we can trust conservatives. Malcolm says that we catch hell not because we're Democrats or Republicans, we catch hell because we're black. And unless Al Sharpton and Ben Jealous and Tom Jonas understand that, they can leave Cornel West and Tavis Smiley alone, who raises issue according to the black agenda.
You seem to be saying that these men whose names you mentioned are more interested in defending President Obama than in defending black people.
No question they have sold their souls to this administration, and Ben Jealous in particular. Here's a brother that no one even knew of, never heard of. He became the president of the NAACP. The first thing he did was not to concentrate on black poverty, which he had never raised that issue. He concentrated on justifying gay rights. What is that? Not economic development, but gay rights. Not arguing for more black businesses, but gay rights. This is a travesty. And then once he has made his money, he's bailing out and going to work for one of the white liberal think tanks to make millions and millions of dollars and ignoring black folks. So he has used the black community, and then he's bailing out at the time that we really need him the most, and then he's going to go make millions and millions of dollars off of the black vote. I mean, what hypocrisy. Tom Jonah is another case. We love Tom Jonah. We have listened to him. We have supported his business. We have supported his show. And then Tavis has been a major entity in that show. And once he had gotten to national prominence, he turned his back on Tavis when Tavis has ever raised legitimate issues. And what people don't understand is that when Tavis used to hold these black American forums, you know of them, I know of them, I've never been invited to one, but I've sat in the audience of those forums, there was an agreement made with all black leaders that they will hold whoever is in the White House toward the black agenda. There were members from the CBC, there were members from Tom Jonah, there was Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and everybody else. They agreed to the covenant, and the covenant said, whoever in the White House, we will hold their feet to the fire concerning the black agenda in terms of health care, in terms of education, in terms of housing, in terms of energy, in terms of whatever was the black agenda. And then, surprisingly and wonderfully, President Barack Obama won, and everybody refused to hold the president feet to the fire regarding these issues. When you look at statistically, black folks have no reason to vote for him because our statistics has gone up and not down under him.
Is his grip on black public opinion slipping?
I'm sad to say it is not, largely because the white Republicans have given another reason for black folks to support the president, despite the fact that the statistic says that black folks are doing worse under this president than any other president. So as long as white conservatives attack this president, black folks feel an obligation to protect this president and to be silent about their condition in light of the fact that they themselves and their families are catching the worst economic wave ever in 20 years. But because of the issue of pride and not trying to disrespect this president, they are willing to suffer in silence. And what the black church is saying, you do not have to suffer in silence. You are a child of God. You are citizens of this country. You deserve your dignity just like everybody else. You voted for this president. They win, so he owes you something. That's how politics work. You do not have to hold your peace. And because black folks are holding their peace, the black church has to step up and defend the poor. And that's what we are doing. We're defending those who defend the poor, and that's why we wrote this press release and telling the black community, leave Tavis and Cornel West alone. Take your hands off these brothers. They are defending the integrity and the worthiness of the black community.
Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative in Washington. For a long time in the United States, political parties with the word socialist in their name couldn't get elected dog catcher. This year, however, the Socialist Alternative Party has good prospects of winning city council seats in Seattle and Minneapolis. Ty Moore is the Socialist Alternative candidate in Minneapolis.
We've had a huge outpouring of support. We've had substantial financial contributions, volunteer support, et cetera. Now, you know, even the mainstream newspaper here, the Star Tribune, is saying this race is very close, that there's a chance of a openly socialist, movement-based candidate defeating the Democratic Party's nominated candidate, which the Democratic Party has run this city with a near monopoly for four decades.
Well, back in the day, there used to be a strong socialist strain in Minnesota politics, but that's a long time ago.
Yeah, Minneapolis has a history of working class struggle and specifically socialist politics. You have the Trotskyists who led the Teamsters strike. You have the Farmer Labor Party with Floyd B. Olson. in power in the 30s. But for decades, the Farmer Labor Party was co-opted back into the Democrats. And so really, you haven't seen a strong left in this city for a long time. But, you know, the effects of the economic crisis are really hammering working class communities here. We have one neighborhood in predominantly African-American North Minneapolis that's seen over half the homes foreclosed on since the crisis began. And I'm running in South Minneapolis, and in just two small neighborhoods, there's been over 1,000 foreclosures since the crisis began. We've declared that area an eviction-free zone now, and that's been my Ward 9 where I'm running.
Now, the people in the various neighborhoods were introduced to you not as a socialist alternative party person, but as part of, well, a lot of folks who were trying to help alleviate dire problems that were facing these communities.
Yeah, I've lived in a neighborhood for over a decade in Minneapolis for over 12 years and been involved in a lot of community struggles. And socialist alternative played a significant role in fighting against charter school encroachment. We helped lead a movement to keep North High Public School open. We've done work around the foreclosure issue. We've done a lot of youth organizing around military recruitment in the schools. So people know us and they know the work I've done. And I think when you get down to it, if we win this race, it's not because a majority of working class residents in Ward 9, South Minneapolis are socialists, but it's because they're angry at this system and they see that the people running this city have clearly sided with the rich and big business, and that, you know, our organization, myself, has built roots in the community fighting back and consistently standing up for the interests of working people.
And what's your platform for confronting those issues?
The four main points that we're emphasizing are a moratorium on foreclosures and affordable housing for all, $15 an hour minimum wage. You know, a lot of cities in the country have raised minimum wage even above state standards, and despite Democratic Party control of the state legislature, we still have minimum wage actually below the federal one. We're calling for an end to police profiling and abuse and an end to deportations of immigrants. And finally, we're calling for full funding for public transit and education by taxing the rich. You know, these are obviously just sort of talking points, and there's limits sometimes to what city government can do. But for us, what real representatives of the people ought to be doing is standing up and pushing and even organizing demonstrations at the state legislature to demand higher taxes on the rich. That's what they should be doing, not just sending lobbyists to quietly and ineffectually supposedly fight for the people's interests. There hasn't been a organized independent socialist elected to a major city council in a couple decades in this country. But I think we're at a historical turning point. The Occupy movement, the grinding economic crisis is now over 5 years in, and just the accumulation of class anger at the huge inequalities that have developed, the structural racism that has continued to destroy our communities. Minnesota, by the way, has the highest racial achievement gap in the schools and the highest jobs gap, one of the highest in the country. These problems have developed a tremendous rage. And when I'm going door to door in working class neighborhoods, we're finding people very open to the idea that the whole system is rotten. The whole system is broken. This government shutdown is like an exclamation point on that pre-existing consciousness. And so I think there's openness for the left, for socialists to make a breakthrough. I don't think what we're doing here in Minneapolis or what our organization is also doing in Seattle, we're running a very competitive citywide council race. I don't think that's anything unique. I think the left needs to sort of wake up and recognize the huge opportunities that exist and rally in city after city in this country. The Democratic Party is a one-party monopoly. And I think the left gets its act together and really mounts a serious, credible challenge, building coalitions with trade unions and community groups. We can really make a difference.
That was Ty Moore of Socialist Alternative in Minneapolis. 3 years ago this month, Haitians began coming down with cholera. The disease has now killed more than 8,000 people and sickened hundreds of thousands more. The medical consensus is that cholera was brought into Haiti by United Nations peacekeeping troops. But the UN says that it cannot be held responsible. Last week, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti filed a suit in federal court demanding that the UN be held accountable. Brian Concannon is director of the Institute. We ask Concannon, how can the UN speak of the rule of law while holding itself immune from the consequences of its actions?
The UN's refusal to accept the rule of law in this case obviously deeply undermines its ability to promote the rule of law elsewhere. Just as one example among many, some police trainer or a judicial trainer went into a room with a Haitian judge or a prosecutor or police officer and gave him a lecture about how everybody needs to abide by the rule of law and you need to sacrifice your short-term interests of you personally in order for the society to have a rule of law that's good for everybody. Now, that will sound deeply cynical to the Haitian listening to that speech coming from an organization that has said the law doesn't apply to it.
We hear pro-Haitian and Haitian activists saying that they've been told by UN personnel that raising the question of cholera hurts the donation process. That is, international donors don't want to donate to Haiti as long as this stink is in the air about cholera.
I think that there's an important distinction to be made in donations between justice and charity. A lot of the donations that have been made to Haiti, and a lot of the programs, are charity. It's people giving their excess what they want to give now, and it generally tends to be addressing symptoms, giving people something to eat, housing, without addressing the underlying injustices that keep Haitians from being able to grow their own food and build their own houses. And I think it's short-sighted to say, well, we need a little bit of money now for a feeding program, so therefore we can't address the underlying problem that's killing 1,000 Haitians every year, which is cholera.
The United Nations is there, supposedly, in order to safeguard the well-being of Haitians. And yet, this is probably the one greatest threat to the well-being of Haitians that has occurred outside of the earthquake itself.
Yes, and it's important to note that although the UN says it doesn't have any money to try to eradicate cholera, the Security Council just today renewed the mandate of MINUSTAH, which I don't know the budget for this year, but in the last year it spent over $500 million on soldiers. And this is in a country that has not had a recognized war in our lifetime. And so the UN has plenty of money to pay for soldiers driving around the country in armored personnel carriers, pointing their weapons in the direction of peaceful market women and peasants, but it doesn't have enough money to try to address a very real cholera epidemic that is killing people every day.
If the United Nations Security Council has immunity from prosecution for what it does with its forces, I guess that really means that those members of the Security Council convey upon themselves immunity if they deploy the UN to do their bidding.
Certainly in Haiti, there's a feeling that the UN is there to do the bidding of the great powers, especially the United States. There actually was a WikiLeaks memo released a couple of years ago where the U.S. ambassador to the UN called MINUSTAH, the UN peacekeeping mission, a cost-effective way of advancing U.S. policy in Haiti. It's important to note with the UN's immunity, it is not an absolute immunity. The UN does not even claim to have an absolute immunity of not ever having to compensate people hurt by its actions. In fact, the UN says over and over again in both treaties that are binding on it as well as its own internal documents that it does have an obligation to compensate people and that if there's a dispute that it will provide an alternate mechanism for people claiming injury to have their claims adjudicated. Now, what the UN is saying in this case is that it is making an exception to the rule of compensation because for some reason the dumping of its poison waste in Haiti's largest river is a matter of policy. There's no justification under law for that exception. And we're really saying that the UN needs to be held accountable to its own obligations to compensate people. So we're not asking for anything new. We're asking for the UN to accept its long-established legal obligation. It's also important to note that the UN's immunity, it's a two-way street. The UN gets protection from national courts, but in return for that, it does offer to provide people alleging harm by the UN an alternate way of having their claims heard. And if the UN refuses to uphold its end of the bargain, courts should not allow it to exercise immunity. There's courts all over the world, especially in Europe, are starting to establish more and more case law saying that international organizations like the UN, although they haven't yet extended to the UN, but international organizations that don't provide people an alternative mechanism are not allowed to invoke immunity when they get to a national court.
You're suing on behalf of victims of cholera. Why isn't the Haitian government suing?
The Haitian government has, until very recently, said it does not support our case and that it does not believe the UN is responsible. I don't think the reason for that is factual. There's very little doubt in anybody's mind that the UN is responsible. I think that the Haitian government has felt that it has limited ability to push the UN because it is dependent on the UN for many things. First of all, the large peacekeeping force, the UN and other international community members bring a lot of money to the Haitian government. And this current government was elected with a very limited popular mandate, in part because it was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that forced the change of electoral results to allow the president to even be in the runoff election. Recently, the Haitian government, under a lot of pressure in Haiti and by Haitian Americans, did change the course a little bit and has said that the UN has moral responsibility and is making some noise about pushing the UN to do better, although it is certainly not willing to go to court or otherwise require the UN to respond justly. On Wednesday night, Navi Pillay, who's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, in a speech in Geneva, explicitly said that the cholera victims should receive compensation. And she's joining many other current and former UN people. The UN's own panel of expert scientists this July said that the UN was the cause of the epidemic. And Jean-Marie Guaheno, who was the head of peacekeeping when MINUSTAH was deployed in Haiti in 2004, he said that the UN, quote, needed to come clean on cholera in Haiti.
Brian Concannon, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, is based in Boston. The presidents of the Central African nations of Rwanda and Uganda, who are deeply implicated in the deaths of 6 million Congolese over the past 17 years, told a visiting United Nations Security Council delegation that peace in the Congo is not their responsibility. We got this reaction from Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo in Washington.
We at Friends of the Congo agree with that sentiment. Kagame and Museveni could never be responsible for bringing peace. What they can be responsible for is for stopping the war of aggression that they've been waging against the Congolese people with U.S. support, U.S. financial support, military support, training, and equally as important, U.S. diplomatic and political cover at the international level. So, yeah, we're in agreement with them. They're not responsible for peace, but they certainly are responsible for stopping the war, and the U.S. is responsible for stopping its support of their allies' war of aggression against the Congolese people.
The United States has announced that it will do further cutbacks in military aid to Rwanda.
Yes, that's important in the sense that's a reflection of the pressure that continues to be put on the Obama administration for it to cease all military support of its allies in the region. As you said at the outset, has raged a 17-year war of aggression against the Congolese people has resulted in at least 6 million people dead since 1996.
Well, Rwanda and Uganda have been playing tag team in the Congo militarily. Why no sanctions against Uganda as well?
I think there should be sanctions against Uganda as well, without a doubt. But what is interesting is that Rwanda has played a more prominent role, at least as of late. Uganda has been far less flamboyant and bellicose in its reaction to UN reports and accusations of its support of M23 inside of the Congo. But Rwanda is by far ahead of Uganda in terms of exercising direct control over the M23 militia inside of the Congo. The UN Security Council Group of Experts report actually named the individuals, the top-level individuals in the Rwandan government that's directing and controlling the M23.
Of course, Rwanda is a very small country. It could not possibly have waged this 17-year war in the Congo without massive support from the United States. So why would Rwanda be acting so defiantly at this stage in the game?
That's an excellent question. They're acting defiantly because they've come to expect carte blanche from the United States. They know the U.S. is pretty much giving them a free rein in the region. So to a certain extent, they're saying to President Obama and the U.S. administration, listen, you're in this game with us, so why is it that now you're raising issues when we're not really doing anything different than we've done for the past 17 years? So I sense that's a little bit where the defiance is coming from, because even as the U.S. cut a few hundred thousand dollars here and issue statements on a weekly basis calling on Rwanda to cease the support of M23, U.S. is still providing up to $200 million a year to the Rwandan regime. U.S. is still providing a platform for Kagame here in the U.S., whether it's with government officials or like we had recently in New York at Cooper's Union, where you had people like Edelson and Elie Wiesel and all giving Kagame a platform to speak to the American public as a hero, as opposed to a villain that many of the Congolese have come to know him.
And what does the Congolese government need to do to bring us closer to an end to this bloodshed?
Wow. The Congolese government is a part of the problem. It lacks legitimacy. It stole the 2011 elections. It has been cozy, both with Uganda and Museveni and with Rwanda and Kagame. So it's a part of the problem that's not often discussed. I've shared with you in the past that the Congolese people are really trapped in a dictatorial network with Kagame in Rwanda, Museveni in Uganda, and Kabila in the Congo. And it's this dictatorial network that the people are fighting to break loose from. And until this network, which is fully backed by the United States on a whole series of levels, until that network is broken, we're going to see the persistent violence and conflict in the region. So it's really important to get over to your listeners that those three leaders, Kabila, Kagame, and Museveni, are the bane of the existence, not only of the Congolese people, but of the Rwandan and Ugandan masses as well. Those people who are fighting for peace, justice, and human dignity in the region.
And the United States is by far the most dominant influence over all three of them.
Without a doubt, they could not exist and sustain themselves without the United States. That's why it's vital for us to continue to expose the role that the U.S. is playing in the region, to pressure the Obama administration to change its policy in the region, or at the very least, we need to make them defend it, raise the contradictions, keep the pressure on. That's the role that we need to play here on the outside as people on the ground mobilize and organize to rid themselves of those regimes.
And of course, Friends of Congo, who organize and mobilize all year long, are celebrating Congo Week next week.
Yes, we have a special commemoration each year, the third week of October, where people throughout the globe mobilize and come to the side of the Congolese people to commemorate the lives that have been lost, the millions of lives that have been lost, and also to elevate the profile of the Congo. So it's important for people to visit us at congoweek.org to see what's going on, where they can get involved. And we have very special events in New York under the guise of Congo and Harlem. So folks can visit us there as well at congoandharlem.org to be a part of this global movement for peace, dignity, and change in the heart of Africa.
Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo. A delegation of American peace activists recently returned from a trip to Syria, where they met with President Bashar Assad. They arrived in the Syrian capital shortly after President Obama was compelled to cancel his military strike on the country. Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center was part of the delegation.
We went on the trip to confront the demonization of Syria. And what we found was an extremely militant resistance attitude everywhere and a great deal of confidence or determination. I think one of the things that impressed us the most, we went to Mount Kesiyun, where hundreds of youth have set up, at their own initiative and stayed there, a human shield. Mount Kesiyun is where the communication center is, a mountain that overlooks all of Damascus. It has been bombed several times just in the last few months by the Israelis, but it is where the communications, phone, internet, everything is for Damascus. So they knew this would be a target. And on the night that it seemed U.S. bombardment was going to begin, hundreds of young people took this mountain and set up an encampment. The name of the encampment is called Over Our Dead Bodies. So that just gives some of the attitude of resistance. There's neighborhood defense teams that have been set up now in every neighborhood. It's not just seen as a military struggle, because the struggle is in every city. The figures are horrendous for what's taking place in Syria. A third of the population are displaced, 5 million internally and 2 million in refugee camps outside. So this is a huge problem for Syria to deal with, that measure, that proportion of people displaced from their homes by more than 1,200. I mean, just think of that number. That's what the U.S. claims, 1,200 of these different mercenary bands that they are arming and equipping and paying. We had a meeting as a way of confronting the demonization here with President Assad. The reason for that is the number one U.S. demand for 2.5 years has been that Assad must step down, that he's illegitimate, that he must resign, must leave, and that these puppet forces that they're arming and equipping must become the government, must be the central part of any negotiated solution, and so on. So it's important to confront that and say, no, this is up to the Syrian people to decide.
Is there a feeling in Syria that the war has turned a corner?
I think so. I really do. The view of many, many people is not a military struggle, that the army is only one part of it, that the neighborhood defense, that politically people understanding what they're fighting for, is extremely important. By the way, it's put here as if Syria was forced down by the U.S. on the chemical weapons. The way the Syrians posed it again and again was that since 2003 they had publicly proposed, this was something that President Assad also said to us, he said, it's Syria that proposed making the whole region a nuclear-free and chemical-free weapons zone. It's the U.S. who refused. And so the U.S. now to demand that Syria disarm its chemical weapons, Syria said, we agree to the Russian proposal to disarm. I'm just saying these are subtle differences, but they're important in the way it's seen in Syria, that the chemical weapons on their part were never used because the conventional weapons were very successfully pushing back these armed bands, that it's these militias or mercenaries who time and again, even in the Western press reported, were found with chemical weapons. It doesn't take any kind of a delivery system. As we can remember, the most severe sarin gas attack I think that there's been was in a subway in Tokyo out of a suitcase. So it takes nothing to disperse chemicals and to blame the government. But there is an anxiousness, actually, to get these weapons out so there isn't another excuse by the U.S. for an attack.
Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center in New York. In addition to the wars in the Middle East and Africa, the U.S. is positioning its vast military to confront rising Chinese influence in Asia. However, China is also the biggest holder of United States debt, more than $1 trillion worth. Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, notes that China has warned Washington that it must pay its bills.
So it is quite ironic that the United States is seeking to escalate tensions with its bankers. I'm not sure if that's a sound strategy, to escalate tensions with one's banker. But as the saying goes, if you owe someone $100, that's your problem. But if you owe someone $100 million, well, then it's their problem. And in some ways, that's the dilemma that China faces. I think that the problem the United States faces is that with an impending debt default and concomitant drop in the value of the dollar, the U.S. currency as the principal reserve currency then comes into question, and therefore the ability of the United States basically to turn to the printing press to rescue itself from its many crises and problems then comes into question, which suggests the United States would then have to earn capital the old-fashioned way. That is to say, not through the printing press, but through other means, the means that normal, quote-unquote, countries use to rescue itself from crises and problems. And I'm not sure if the U.S. ruling elite is prepared for that.
Or through the primitive accumulation of war and seizure of resources.
That is true. Always on the agenda for a country like the United States, an imperialist country, the problem there is that an allergy is developing amongst the masses of U.S. people with regard to the shedding of blood. In the United States, homicide is smiled upon frequently, but suicide does not have as much resonance. And increasingly, when the United States goes into Iraq and Afghanistan, there is the distinct possibility that U.S. soldiers will be returning in body bags to grieving families, and that potentially creates a searing political problem.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn. In Philadelphia, activists held a conference to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, a watershed document in civil rights history. Dr. Anthony Montero, professor of African American Studies at Temple University, was one of the organizers. In a speech at Philadelphia's Church of the Advocate, Dr. Montero proposed a framework around which a new local and national movement could unite.
First, our Declaration of the Rights of our people must demand an end to war, threats of war, and preparation for war, the dismantling of the warfare state and the military-industrial complex. You cannot answer the pressing social problems of this country, uppermost being poverty, without dismantling the warfare state. Already $6 trillion on Afghanistan and Iraq, and now Libya and preparation to go to war in Syria. And Syria will be even more serious than Iraq or Afghanistan, because contending forces on both sides of world historical movement are assembled in Syria. The Russians are not backing down. The Iranians are not backing down. Hezbollah is not backing down. And the Syrian government is not backing down. We must call upon the Obama administration to back off of its threats of war. And we all know that the war in Syria is just a beginning step to war with Iran. Along with this, we must demand the dismantling of the national security state and the spying upon the people in violation of our constitutional rights. Second, rather than fund war, we have to fund the needs of the people. There is no rational justification for the levels of poverty that exist in this society. And anybody with an ounce of sense understands that poverty is just a synonym for black. When you say poverty, you're damn near saying black. We need jobs, education, genuine health care, food for the hungry, alternative energy, and a multi-decade war against poverty. As Martin Luther King insisted, war abroad is the enemy of the poor, and we live that every day. Of the top 10 cities in the United States, Philadelphia is at the bottom in terms of the number of people living in extreme poverty. And when they talk about extreme poverty, they're talking about people and families that live on one half of the government-established poverty line. Three, tax the billionaires and the profits of the banks, hedge funds, equity funds, and transnational corporations, real estate speculators, and so on. Many people say, Dr. Montero, are you serious? We can barely win a vote in city council to exempt senior citizens from the rise in property tax. How do you expect there to be a taxation on the rich? And of course, we all know the rich don't pay taxes. You know, that's the reason why they're raising property taxes on ordinary citizens. Because Comcast and these real estate speculators and thieves don't pay any taxes. Tax abatements for them and increased taxes for the ordinary citizen. But again, I agree with Frederick Douglass. Power concedes nothing without a demand. You have to make the demand. And we must tax the rich. Now, they say they pay too much taxes. Well, I'm for the tax rates they were paying in the 1950s and 60s. And I'm talking about taxing profits first and foremost. Now, if you want me to go further, and I want you to think about this, and tax at a higher level the profits of the banks, the financial institutions, the hedge funds, the equity funds, and all of those institutions that deal in credit and paper, the ones that brought the economy down, by the way. Alongside of this tax relief for working people and the poor, including property tax relief. This is an important question, because in the future we cannot fund public education based upon property tax. And it cannot be state by state and city by city. There must be a national fund to finance public education and to equalize the funding of public education. Fourth, dismantle and nationalize the too-big-to-fail banks. You know, part of the rationale of the economic policies of the Bush II and Obama administrations was that these banks like Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Wachovia, Bank of America, and on, were too big to fail. If they failed, they told us, the whole system would come down. Well, there was an alternative that was never discussed. The government taking over the banks. The government literally put $12 trillion into those banks to so-called save the too big to fail. That was money that was taken from the people to save the banks. Why didn't the government just take over the banks? Today the banks have $2 trillion in their coffers that they do nothing with. Well, they speculate in different parts of the world with it. But that's the people's money, and it has to be appropriated to serve the interest of the people. Fifth, we need a single-payer universal health care plan. What we have now, I can tell you right now, is not going to work. Not because of Republican obstructionism, but because it is not about health care for the people, it's about profits for the pharmaceutical companies and the health care industry. And any system, be it education, public education, or health care, that is privatized to make profit for a few will never serve the interests of the people. And just like privatizing education has not served public education, privatizing health, public health, will not serve the health of our people. We need a single-payer universal health care system. Six, reparations for African American and the outlawing of white supremacy in all of its forms. Affirmative action with quotas must be built in to every program that is funded by the federal, state, or local governments. We must not only attack racism at the personal, individual level, we have to attack it at the structural level. And we must attack the economics of white supremacy, the economic motives that make white supremacy profitable. And in that whole scenario, we must end the privatization of prisons and the whole system of prison labor. Seven, break the stranglehold of money on politics, end the moribund and useless two-party system, allow a genuinely multi-party political system of both running for election and governing the country to come into existence. 8, along with a $5 trillion war on poverty and hunger, we need a $10 trillion jobs and infrastructure program with training, affirmative action, and quotas immediately. You know, one of the things about this current economic crisis is that unemployment remains very high. For African Americans, official unemployment is double that of white Americans. But the actual unemployment is something like 20% overall. But if you go to neighborhoods in North Philadelphia, Strawberry Mansion, West Oak Lane, Southwest Philadelphia, South Philly, where black people are concentrated, among young people you see unemployment levels reaching 70%. No young person has worked, and damn near every one of them has been to jail. In fact, it is no secret that the police force in the city of Philadelphia functions to control and manage the poor and the unemployed. 9, restructure the prison system. Do away with solitary confinement. This is one of the hidden evils of the prison system. Just yesterday, one of the great heroes of the prison reform movement died after doing 42 years in solitary confinement in Angola prison in Louisiana, Herman Wallace. We must acknowledge his martyrdom and his heroism. We can't say enough about Herman Wallace and his two colleagues who were put in solitary confinement not because they committed a crime, but because they joined and formed the Black Panther Party chapter in prison and stood up for the rights of the prisoners. And you should know, Angola Prison is named after the plantation where it is built. And they call it Angola because most of the people who were on that plantation came from the African nation of Angola. But the prison system must cease to be a system of punishment and revenge to one of rehabilitation, education, job training. We must decriminalize drugs and end the so-called war on drugs. There must be an end to the death penalty. And we must call for the freedom of all political prisoners and an end to the system of imprisoning for decades people whose only crime is that they stood up to the system and for the rights of the people. This is a very complicated moment in our collective history. We look back to the Birmingham jail letter and to the Birmingham movement to learn lessons of how we move forward. One thing is clear. We might not get it all right, but one thing is for certain, if we do nothing, nothing will change.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia. Herman Wallace, who spent 41 years in solitary confinement in Louisiana prisons, died earlier this month of liver cancer, just 2 days after a judge set him free. Wallace was a former Black Panther, as is the nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, serving a life sentence in Pennsylvania. Mumia saluted Herman Wallace in a commentary on Prison Radio.
Herman Wallace, the former Black Panther and former political prisoner in the abominable Angola prison in Louisiana, has returned to his ancestors. Wallace, one of three men called the Angola Three, was freed just days ago after 41 years in the hole, one of the longest terms ever spent in solitary on Earth. He gained his freedom after a federal judge in Louisiana ruled his murder conviction was unconstitutional and unjust and granted a habeas corpus petition ordering immediate release. Ill, suffering from terminal liver cancer, Over 70 years old, his spirit was as strong as ever. Herman may have no longer been a Panther, but he remained a revolutionary. He and his fellow ex-Panthers, Robert Hillary King and Albert Woodfox, comprised the Angola Three and fought for their freedom from the corrupt courts and prisons of Louisiana for decades. King was released in 2001. Albert Woodfox is still encaged, sentenced to life in the hole. These men were sentenced to life in solitary for what officials have termed Black Pantherism. The three men made Black Panther Party history when they organized a branch of the organization while prisoners at Angola. That gives us some sense of the soul and strength of the men. In a recent broadcast on public TV called Herman's House, a supporter living in the house gets a call from Herman, and she can barely hold back her tears as the courts had recently denied him relief. Herman consoles his supporter, explaining in a rich southern accent, "That's the struggle, girl." Explaining, "That's what happens in the struggle. People lose and get up and struggle some more." For 41 years, Herman Wallace endured government torture, but he never broke. He never renounced the revolutionary path. He remained a soldier for the people and an opponent to the system. Herman Wallace truly died free.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, make arrangements to attend our 7th anniversary celebration and fundraiser at New York's historic Riverside Church on Friday, October 18th. Last year's event was fantastic, and we guarantee that this year will be even better. So go to the Black Agenda Report site and sign up now for the October 18th celebration. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.